Get ready for a high adventure with the new children's adventure series, The Only Living Boy. Harvey Award winners David Gallagher and Steve Ellis' critically acclaimed web series to print is now a riveting graphic novel exclusively from Papercuts. When Eric runs away from home, he finds himself lost, without his memory, on a patchwork planet under a broken moon. He may be the only living boy, but he's not alone. The world is filled with dangerous creatures fighting to decide who is the hunter and who is the hunted. He'll need help from mermaid warrior Morgan and Thea, an insect princess, to escape the foes pitted against them by the dreaded Lord Balakar and fiendish Dr. Once. Can Eric defeat their evil plans and find his way home? Mental Floss calls The Only Living Boy an all-ages adventure book inspired by pulp serials, Saturday morning cartoons, Jack Kirby, and even the music of Paul Simon. The Only Living Boy, Volume 1, Prisoner of the Patchwork Planet, is on sale in bookstores everywhere on March 8th. Learn more at olbcomic.com.
In 1977, Voyager 2 was launched into space to the outermost regions of the universe. It carried an invitation in all languages for alien life forms to visit our planet. Someone, somewhere, listened and accepted our invitation. Get ready. Someone is coming. Someone like no one she has ever known before.
Can you clone a living organism from the hair of a dead man?
We're hypothesizing a technology that's probably 100,000 years ahead of us.
He has powers we cannot imagine, and the face and touch of the man she loved.
Sends greetings.
What's the matter with you?
How much English do you understand?
I understand greetings in 54 planet Earth languages.
Do you seriously expect me to tell the president that an alien has landed, assumed the identity of a dead house painter, and is presently out tooling around the countryside in a hopped-up 1977 Mustang?
You're not from around here, are you?
Think of what it would mean to talk to a being from a civilization like that. Think of what we could learn.
You don't understand. There isn't much time, please. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. Can't you just leave him alone?
What the hell ever happened to good manners? We invited him here.
So far to come. So much to do. So little time to fall in love. Look up. Company's coming. John Carpenter's Starman.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water family of podcasts, or network of podcasts, I should say. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this week to talk about John Carpenter's 1984 sci-fi film Starman, starring Jeff Bridges and my favorite, Karen Allen, is a writer and comics historian. His work has appeared in and on Den of Geeks, Up Rocks, Topless Robot, Geekadelphia, Celebrity, and he's the producer and host of Sci-Fi Explosion, Chris Cummins. Chris, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me on. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to this. Now, as many of you that listen to the show regularly, and thank you that you do, the normal way I do this is I find someone who wants to come on the show, and then I say to them, what movies do you want to talk about? And then we'll you know, they always send me a list, and there's always one or two at least we can pick from there. This is done the opposite way in that I realized I wanted to talk about John Carpenter's Starman. It's a great movie. I love John Carpenter, as everyone knows. And so I reached out on Facebook and said, who wants to talk about Starman? And I got crickets. I was like, what's going on? So I was ready to sort of put it aside because I didn't want to do it by myself. And then luckily, Chris sent me a message out of nowhere saying, hey, if you haven't found anybody to talk about Starman, I'll do it, which I was thrilled about because I've read a lot of Chris's stuff and he knows what he's talking about. He's a big geek like the rest of us. And anyone who volunteers to talk about a movie, you know they're going to love it. So, again, Chris, thank you for coming on. And like, let's talk about Starman. Why do you like this movie so much?
I like it so much because it's kind of a movie that just it jumps genres. I mean, you go in expecting like this kind of maybe intellectual heavy you know, science fiction tale. Oh, a man from the stars, you know, what's this going to be about? Is it going to be like a man who fell to earth type deal?
Right.
Where it's going to be kind of very, very probing and have a lot to say on the human condition, but maybe not in the nicest way. Or is it going to be, you know, an E.T. feel good affair? And what it comes down to is it's kind of a mix of both, but more than anything else, it's this sci-fi love story, which, you know, coming on the heels of E.T. success, I know Starman was, you know, a huge hit for the studio, but I feel like it's not in the public's consciousness enough these days. So I kind of like to go and whenever anyone talks about like John Carpenter's movies or like underrated sci-fi films of the 80s, I always like to bring up Starman because this is a movie that has a lot of things that are extremely appealing. Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen are at their absolute finest here. Bridges especially has a very difficult role to play as the title character, the Starman, who comes to Earth, inhabits basically the body of Karen Allen's dead husband, and then they go on a road trip together. and there's really so much happening here, but at the heart of it, it is just this simple love story, and it's about, you know, it has some interesting things to say about grief, the grieving process, and how, you know, it raises this question of why are we reaching out to the stars if we have aliens come here? What would that experience be like for them? And it wouldn't be like the most possible thing. So so it's a movie that's raising a bunch of different points, and you know, but never losing sight of the romance that's at the core of it.
Yeah, you mentioned, certainly Jeff Bridges does a great performance. He was Oscar nominated for this, the only time any John Carpenter movie has ever been nominated for an Oscar,
right,
for any reason, which is sad.
yeah, right.
You know, we all love John Carpenter's movies. And this film really does sort of stick out in his filmography. I mean, he had an extraordinary run from the late mid-70s to the mid-80s. I mean, all in a row: Assault and Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog, Escape from New York, The Thing, Christine, then this movie, Starman, then Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, They Live. I mean, those are all great movies to one degree or another, but Starman is certainly his kindest. I know that he received a hell of a lot of criticism for doing The Thing, because The Thing came out right around the time E.T. did, and as he put it on the audio commentary he does for that movie, you know, E.T. was a cuddly alien, and theirs was not, certainly. Right. So Starman feels almost like he wanted to, not atone, that's not the right term, but like wanted to prove that he could do something that was just a little nicer and a little kinder. And this movie is a very sweet, kind movie. Now, it does feature, of course, your classic, you know, bad guy in the form of Richard Jekyll, who plays this army commander that wants to basically kill Jeff Bridges because they know he's an alien. But then you also have the character played by Charles Martin Smith, who is very much sort of like Richard Dreyfuss from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He wants to understand this alien and wants to welcome him. I mean, as he puts it, you know, we asked him to come. We welcome these aliens, and now we want to kill them. And so the characters, except for Jekyll, are all very, very sort of nice to one another, and that's not typical for a Carpenter movie.
Yeah, and those are all great points. And really another thing that's so interesting about this is, like, it really is – I mean, I think not since, like, his Elvis movie did Carpenter make a movie that was so geared towards the mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, even though, I mean, obviously with it being, you know, sci-fi, you know, having those trappings, it could get pushed aside to that kind of niche or genre. But more than anything, this is this huge romance. And I think that's really, you know, like Bridges and Allen's performances are what made it so appealing to the public at large. Like that and just the story of, you know, oh, a man came from space to love me. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who listens to the show knows I am just completely smitten with Karen Allen. I always have been. I mean, I it started with Marion Ravenwood. I mean, to me, she's the single greatest female character in the history of the movies. I kind of refuse to argue that point.
I don't think you're wrong, by the way.
It's very good.
It's important to say that. At least the Marion of of Raiders.
Yes.
Anyway, maybe
yeah.
not so much
Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah, maybe I mean, not so much that one.
No,
but, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's ironically enough, I said, you know, John Carpenter talks a lot about, in all his interviews, how much he loves Howard Hawks. That's like his
right.
major influence. And Karen Allen, in a lot of her movies, especially Marion Ravenwood, is a very Hawksian leading lady. She's
sure.
tough, and she's tough here. I mean, she's when she, you know, when we first see her, and she, her face is really the first human that we see. There's
right.
the opening scene in space, and we see everything, you know, all the stuff that's going on. But the first human face that we see in this movie is of her as she's sitting in the house all by herself, just watching old films of her and her husband. And she's drinking and smoking, and she's clearly just sort of not doing anything with her time as she's in mourning. But she. You know, she deals with this incredibly strange set of circumstances pretty well. I mean, she freaks out a couple of times, as you might
right.
imagine, if your dead
sure.
husband is reanimated in the form of a baby right in front of you, which is the really creepy baby puppet.
Oh, it's so when I was watching it to revisit this today, I was just like, I forgot how kind of disturbing that whole sequence was.
Yeah, very David Cronenberg, kind of
yeah.
the brood,
yeah.
that little baby that grows, and he grows to full size, but he was right in front of her. But she tries to escape a bunch of times as they go on the road, and. And she handles herself pretty well. And I said, I can't help but feel that that's just John Carpenter's perfect woman. Is that kind of
sure.
she would have fit in like kind of well on The Thing, you know?
Yeah.
She would
oh,
have been
yeah,
able
definitely.
To hold her own up there in the outpost.
Yeah, for sure. I think what's great about Allen is she can do like she can go from toughness to vulnerability. She can turn on a dime.
Yeah.
And just you always – I mean even in films like Scrooge, which are primarily comedic films, she always gives – like she gives such an amazingly human performance in everything that she does, especially these mainstream pictures that she was doing in the 80s, because she does have this relatability. She does have this every woman quality, but there's something more to it than just that. Like she really has this kind of strength, and she's able to project that and really win over her audiences.
Yeah, she exudes an amazing amount of warmth. And that's – I know we're getting already off topic, but, like, no one really likes Crystal Skull. I don't know anybody that likes that movie.
Right.
But I always sort of looked at it as I was happy I'm okay with that movie existing simply because it gave Marion Ravenwood another – kind of bite at the apple, you know. It was
sure.
like it brought her back, and it sort of signified everyone knows she was the best of the
right.
three.
Yeah, I mean the best scene is, you know, in that film is when Indy makes the comment like, "I didn't settle down because none of these other women were you." That's
yep.
that is my favorite scene in that film, hands
yeah.
down.
Yeah, but we should get back to Starman,
because sure,
I'll go on and on about Karen Allen if you let me, you know. But basically, after the Starman lands and takes possession of Karen Allen's dead husband's body, he reveals that he has been stranded on Earth and he has to get back to his home planet, and he's going to meet up with aliens. His people in 3 days' time in this canyon down in Arizona. So it basically becomes a road movie, which apparently, I guess from the research I saw, was what drew Carpenter to it. Apparently, this film was in development for many, many years, and it was much more of a sci-fi type movie with much
right.
more of sci-fi trappings. And it was Carpenter, ironically enough, that stripped all that stuff away. He made it more – he compared it in one quote, so to the Defiant Ones. Because these are people literally sort of trapped together as they travel.
Right, that's great.
And, right, and so there he's pursued by again the army, he's led by Richard Jekyll as well as Charles Martin Smith's character, who just wants to understand him, and they travel on and on, and eventually, of course, she grows to understand that he is not there to wish her any harm.
Right.
He's you know, and he explains about he's sort of perplexed about why. People treat each other the way they do. There's a wonderful scene where they go to a diner and they run across some hunters who have shown up, and these hunters have a dead deer strapped across the hood of their car, and the Starman can't understand why anybody would kill anything not to eat it. And he then reanimates the deer, and the deer just trundles off. And that's really the moment you get the sense that Karen Allen's character starts to really fall in love with him, because
yeah.
he's got this inherent kindness to him And then he also beats the ass of the hunters, which I enjoy. but that's when she really falls in love with him. And then she decides, okay, she's going on the rest of this journey with him to bring him home. Because he mentions if he does not get home, he's going to die. He cannot survive here on Earth.
Yeah, so, I mean, it really is like, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that scene with the deer. Because it still has the emotional impacts watching that scene today as it does in 85. Because she's just... she's ready to leave. She's ready to just ditch him at that point. In fact, she's on her way to do so.
Right.
When she sees him reanimate the deer, and then she realizes, like, okay, like this, you know, this isn't my husband, but what a marvelous, you know, character this whatever this alien is. He realizes how brutal and inhumane this was for these hunters to kill this deer, and just releases it into the wild. And like you said, that is absolutely the moment where she's like, okay, I'm really having feelings for him. And so it's a crucial turning point for the character and also for the movie, because at that point, you know, if audiences weren't already on the side of for this couple, they are at that point 100%. And from there on, the love story is just goes into overdrive.
Right. Well, yeah, literally and figuratively, in that they end up, they end up in the back of a truck at one point, and there's a woman that is there in the back of the truck with them, and she's got a baby, and Karen Allen holds the baby, and her and Starman talk about the fact that she cannot have children, that she's infertile, and she's very, of course, sad about this, that she never got the chance to have a child with her husband. And later on, they hop a train, and that is when they consummate their relationship, and then they make love. And literally the next morning, he informs her that he, as he puts it, gave her a baby.
Right.
And she says, "Well, that's impossible." And he says, No. I know I did. It's going to be a boy, and it's going to be the child of your husband as well as mine. And this child will understand things. He will become a teacher and a leader, I think he says.
Yeah.
Because this kid is going to be obviously a hybrid of these two races, which is, you know, we're kind of used to that in movies. I mean, Superman's always been dating Lois Lane and all those other things. But when it's put, I there's something about the way Bridges plays the character, because he doesn't have time, or not have time. He doesn't understand nuance.
Right.
That he just puts it so bluntly. It's sort of very jarring. You're like, wow, yeah, she's going to have an interspecies baby here. You know, like, this is wow.
Yeah, Bridges' performance is completely without guile throughout the film, but in that scene especially, because like he's like, and whether or not he realizes this is her, like, I mean, there's no way that Starman can at that point realize that this is clearly a thing that really impacted her life when she was married to Scott before he died, that they wanted to have this child together, and she just couldn't because she was physically unable to. So, you know, they do that, and when he says, you know, I can terminate this baby if you want, and she just has this look of like, oh, absolutely not, and then she just gives him this joyous hug, and basically it's like that dream that she had for herself and for her now dead husband is coming true in the most unlikely way possible. So it's another really big moment in the film where, like, you just feel like this weird family unit and what the possibilities of that are going to be, not just for the Jenny character, but for all of humanity, with this kid destined to grow up and become a great leader.
Yeah, it's a movie that we'll get to the end sequence in shortly, but it's a movie that does make you sort of cry out for I want to see this story continue. Actually, I want to see Starman too. Yeah.
Jeff Bridges, I think when Tron Legacy was going around, he apparently has an idea for a sequel.
And does he really? Oh, that's fantastic.
Like, I would love to, you know, I think Tron Legacy was 2010, but I remember seeing, and I'm sure if you Google Starman 2, you'll see Jeff Bridges has idea for Starman 2. Okay, well, let's let it happen. You know, why not? We see he's not opposed to revisiting franchises some 30 years after the fact, so hey.
Yeah, why not? Sure. I mean, I'd love to see John Carpenter come out of retirement. I mean, you know, I still think he's got some good movies left in him. His last one wasn't particularly good, but I have my own theories about that or whatever. But anyway, with Starman after they have make love, they head off. They end up overshooting. They oversleep. They overshoot where they're supposed to go. They end up back in Vegas because Jenny loses her wallet. There's a bit of a kind of a comedy beat where the Starman slash Scott gets the money by tapping the slot machines and making them pay off. So and they end up getting winning like a $500,000 jackpot. They buy a new car. They drive to Arizona, and that's where they end up at this crater. And there's this wonderful scene in a diner that's right outside where this pit is, and that's where they have their first and only meeting with the Charles Martin Smith character, Mark Sherman, who basically just explains to them, you know, I'm here and I really could sort of apprehend the Starman, but I'm going to let him go because it's not the right thing to do. We're not going to – because the character played by Richard Jenkins, George Fox, wants to vivisect him, for Pete's sakes.
Right.
I mean, he's not – he is your classic army guy, you know, sort of army heavy in a movie where he just wants to just kill this alien, for Pete's sake. And it said the movie ends with I guess we're maybe jumping to it at this point, but the movie ends with the scene of the Starman, and there's a sort of beam of light that comes down and takes him away. And this film ends on an extended close-up of Karen Allen's face as she watches him depart into outer space. And I am someone who's really fascinated by movies that have really great final shots.
Yeah.
And this, to me, is one of the – I mean, it sounds almost – it sounds like hyperbole a little. But to me, it is one of the greatest final shots in all of cinema. I am so taken by this shot of this close-up of Karen Allen. I mean, I know – again, I love her, you know, and I'm totally crushing on her. But I just feel it's – there aren't that many actors that you could hold on for the final minute or minute and a half of your movie and have that work. But to me, it does. The fact that it ends on just her lovely face as she watches him depart, it's just startling. And to me, it helps Starman go from a very good movie to – a great one because of that final shot. I mean, it was amazing. I would love to know how Carpenter conceived it, what the script said, but I never get tired of looking at that final sequence. I think it's just – it's simply magical.
Well, I have to say you're absolutely correct. I don't know if I'm just biased towards the film or Karen Allen or whatever, but you're absolutely right. And I mean – that is – it is – first off, it is a surprisingly lengthy shot. I watched it again – I watched the movie again today in preparation for this. But just waiting that – like I forgot how kind of – how stunning it is that you see, because there's the lights going off and it goes from – she's bathed in this red light of the alien ship until it goes to day. And during that, she's emoting everything from like – sadness because he's leaving again, and she's leaving, like she's basically losing another surrogate husband, to like happiness that she had this kind of second chance with this you know, stranger from the stars. And then there's like this it ends on what I perceive is just this hope in her face for like, wow, I had this amazing experience, I can't wait to see what happens next. And also, like, there's gratitude thrown in there. And man, is Karen Allen delivering, like, this performance that audiences can read just all these emotions onto it, because she's such a strong actress in that scene. And to know that she's probably just looking at a wall
when
they were filming it is just, like, it's just stunning that she's able to bring all this out and project it on the audience. And like you said, that shot of her face just hangs there. And it is captivating, and it is haunting, and it is an absolutely gorgeous shot. And I will totally stand by your assertion that this is one of the greatest shots in cinema history.
I love this.
I don't think that that's hyperbole at all. I think it's just – I think it's strength, and like you said, it makes it go from a good movie to a great movie. And this – I mean, look, we can get into debate if you want if this is Carpenter's best directed movie or strongest movie. I don't know. It might be, but that shot – is definitely kind of a check in the column that this may be his strongest film directorial wise.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that she is basically the first face you see and the last face you see, and you know, Bridges got a lot of attention. Again, we mentioned he got an Oscar nomination, and well deserved, because he's terrific in the movie. But this is the story is told through her eyes, and the fact that it's because you can't know him. I mean, similar to the way, you know, forgive the comparison, but sort of the way that Rain Man is told through Tom Cruise's eyes, not through Dustin Hoffman's eyes, because you can't know Rain Man. You know, there's that wall up there, and you can't get through it. And so the fact that Karen Allen is really the our passenger through this story. And it makes me, I don't know, I don't want to say sad, because it's not like I have sympathy for her, because she's had a great life and she's had a great career. But I always feel like she should have been bigger. Like, why, you know, like she delivered some amazing performances in a couple of movies in a very short period of time. And I'm like, why wasn't she a bigger star than this? Did Hollywood not know what to do with her after that? I don't understand.
This is a conversation that I've had with several of my friends a few times. And I think what it is I think Karen Allen is one of these actresses who just kind of follows her own muse. And maybe she realized that, like, that what Hollywood was turning into wasn't kind of a place that she wanted to do. She would rather do her own projects, you know, and do her own, you know, personal things and things like that. So I think she kind of – I don't think it was the sort of thing where she was pushed out as so much as she just didn't find things that really appealed to her. So she would only do things selectively. The AV Club had a thing this week with Rand.
Right, they just interviewed her. Yeah.
Yeah, they just interviewed her. And, like, one thing that I'm always shocked about is, like, how big of a deal The Sandlot is and her role in that. Because, I mean, I'm 41, so that was kind of, you know, that was kind of lost on me.
Yeah, me too,
You know, the last great Karen Allen role that I remember was Scrooge.
Yep.
for me, but it was interesting reading that article to hear about, like, other movies that she popped up in that I completely forgot about, like Cruising. She plays between her girlfriend
right.
And I completely forgot about that. So, I mean, she has had an absolutely fascinating career, and I was really pleased to see that AV Club article, just to see that, like, oh, hey, she's still doing these indies and doing what she wants to do. So I feel like I respect that and I admire that. But, yeah, I do wish she was more of a, like, a household name, or was just – she just got more respect that she did. And I hope, like, that AV Club article really stirs things up and gets people realizing that, oh, yeah, she's tremendous. We should really just appreciate her more because of how great she is.
Yeah. I mean, it's maybe, like you said, she just chose to pack it, you know, not pack it in, but just chose to do what she wanted. Maybe the Raiders money was so good that she, the Animal House money, the Cruising money was just such that she could just.
Maybe not so much the Cruising money, but the others for sure. Yeah.
Shoot the moon with Albert Finney. She made a ton of money from that. Yeah. Yeah. She's tremendous. I'm going to have to get off Karen Allen, because this episode will become the Karen Allen episode.
Oh, it'll become, I don't necessarily want it to. Because I love her so much, too. It'll just become a love fest. Yeah.
We should talk about John Carpenter a little bit, because, I mean, how big of a fan of Carpenter are? I'm going to imagine you and I are roughly the same age, and to people our age, Carpenter is up there. You know, he's one of the guys. So where does this fit in your mind? You said it's maybe one of his best director movies. Where does this fit in terms of your favorites of his films?
Okay. This is very – I'll just straight up say it off the bat. I absolutely love John Carpenter. He is one of my favorite directors. If maybe he is my favorite director? I don't know. Like, I
like, had to take a breath there to pause.
Yeah, like, I try not to quantify stuff like that when things I like, because I make myself nuts, because I'm the type of person who, like, makes lists in his head a lot and everything. So – but, yeah, I mean, okay, Carpenter – I like you mentioned that stretch that he was on, that kind of, you know, went through They Live, and there's not one of those films that I don't enjoy, you know, if not just straight out love. What I like about, you know, it sounds pretentious to say, but I think, like, that Starman might be his most mature work. And probably, like I said earlier, his most mainstream. Not my favorite, and that's not to take anything away from it, but, I mean, my favorite Carpenter film is kind of like a Sophie's Choice, because, like, do I go with Big Trouble in Little China? Do I go with Escape from New York? Do I go horror and go for Halloween or The Thing? So it's just, like, it really is, like, picking, like, what child to save. if I had to absolutely go with a favorite, I would probably say Escape from New York with Big Trouble being a close second, but Starman would definitely be third.
Yeah.
And then They Live, and then on and on and on. But,
I even really like Memoirs of an Invisible Man. I mean, I actually think that's a kind of underrated movie. I mean, it's not considered a particularly good one, but I think there's a lot to that you know, had it been done by anybody else. Like, that movie was originally supposed to be directed by Ivan Reitman.
Right.
And I could totally picture what kind of movie it would have been then. But Carpenter brings a whole kind of thing. He was just a really – yeah. I mean, that whole stretch, there is not one movie.
He was on. Yeah, he was absolutely on. Some of the projects that he didn't get made, like the – like the Creature from the Black Lagoon reboot that he was doing.
Oh, that would have been so cool.
The tantalizing, the only thing I know about it was like the from Starlog Magazine, They Live Too, Hypno War. What the hell was that going to be? You know? I have a friend, a filmmaker here in Philadelphia, Chris Asser, and he's probably like, I should have actually put you in touch with him because he's like the biggest Carpenter expert I've ever met and probably on this planet. And he once just spent an afternoon telling me about all these Carpenter projects that didn't happen and why they didn't happen. And just to go through it. And I'm like, when did Carpenter find time to sleep in the 80s with all these projects that he was able to, you know, put out, as well as all this other great stuff that he's hands in that never came to fruition.
Yeah. Oh, that Creature of the Black Lagoon. Oh, that's just, that breaks my heart. It breaks my heart.
It's pretty devastating that that never got to happen.
I mean, he made The Thing, for Pete's sake, one of the great sci-fi reboots of all time. So, I mean, now, did you see his last film? I don't want to say last as in most recent. Let's not say last. The Ward?
I didn't, and here's why. It didn't look appealing to me, and I have this thing. I kind of had the same thing with Joe Dante and The Hole. Like, it bums me out that these guys, because of the way Hollywood is now, and that they kind of have been kind of pushed to doing these kind of low budget, I don't know, not exactly terrifically done films that don't really let their personality come out. You know what I mean? It's just like, I obviously, Carpenter's more than able to handle a small budget. But it's just nothing about it seemed really appealing to me. And he kind of began to really lose me with vampires.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like, so I rather enjoy him as he was. And I'll listen to Lost Themes and Lost Themes 2 and see him in New York and do whatever. Like, if he wants to keep doing this Lost Themes tour, that's great. But unless he's doing Escape from Earth with Kurt Russell, like, I don't know at this point, film wise. I think he may be. You know, I think he may not have the hunger for it he used to.
Yeah, I watched The Ward simply because it was, you know, I was like, I can't resist. And it made me sad because it's generic. It's a generic movie. And it could have been made by anybody of these guys, you know, any of these guys that just make these sort of PG-13, you know, things jumping out at you and stuff like that. And I was like, this is not a John Carpenter movie. And again, who am I to cast aspersions on this great director, but like, I feel like he needs like a Quentin Tarantino. He needs somebody who has a lot of clout in Hollywood that can say, okay, I'm going to give one of my heroes $20 million. Go make your movie, John. Just go make it, and you'll talk to me. You're not going to talk to the studio. Right. You'll talk to me, and we'll make the movie you want to make. I almost say the same thing about Joe Dante. I feel like that's what they need, is somebody that grew up on those movies and is now like a Chris Nolan. You know, just somebody who has got the real is a big deal in Hollywood now, and has the ability to just say, Quentin Tarantino presents a John Carpenter film, Escape from Earth. You know,
right? Yeah,
done. Well,
Let me take you into my little fantasy parallel universe that I live in. And it was a world where Grindhouse was an amazing, amazingly huge hit.
Right.
And it was a world where the Machete films also kind of set the box office on fire, which gave Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez, a guy whose career it just frustrates me to see which way that's going. But that's another episode. But like, I, for a long time there, I was just like, after seeing Planet Terror, I'm like, why isn't Rodriguez making Escape from New York Escape from Earth with Carpenter and Kurt Russell? You know, and when I heard that Russell was in The Hateful Eight, I was just like, man, can he give John Carpenter some work? Can they make something happen? Like, forget that reboot that they keep talking about. Like, I wanted Hateful Eight to be a bigger thing so Kurt Russell would become bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, someone could say, Kurt, you have any projects you'd really like to make happen? So, you know, the fanboy in me could have him say, yeah, Escape from Earth, you know, because that is something that And I'm not even the world's largest Escape from LA fan. I love it for what it is. But I would love to see the Snake Plissken character again from with Kurt and John Carpenter teaming up one more time.
Yeah, I feel like Carpenter's whole sort of aesthetic just does not fit well with what a modern studio wants to see.
No.
And I'm trying to picture him, and he seems like somebody who, I don't know, maybe not self-destructive, that's probably not accurate, but I just don't get the sense he's someone who really puts up with a lot of bullshit. And
right.
I'm trying to picture him talking to some 30-year-old studio exec with a bunch of data about how this isn't a four-quadrant movie. And Carpenter's like, shut up. You know, like, you probably slap the guy, you know? I just can't. So it's like, that's why I feel like you just need somebody to, John, just go. Just take, go off.
Right.
And just bring back the completed film and we'll just send it.
Which
out.
Is why Tarantino or Rodriguez would be ideal. You know?
Yep. Yeah.
It's interesting you said that about, like, Carpenter, because I kind of picture him as, like, this Terry Gilliam-esque character. Yeah. But whereas Terry Gilliam will just rail against the, you know, will rail against the industry or the Orwellian world we live in or whatever. You know, I mean, like, I love Terry Gilliam too, but I think sometimes he just maybe doesn't have the best ideas for films in the first place. But
I think
anyway.
He's his own worst enemy sometimes.
Yes, he absolutely
that.
Is. But whereas to compare him to Carpenter, I think Carpenter would just be like, you know what? Yeah, screw this. I'm just going to go and play my Xbox, you know. I think that's kind of where Carpenter would lie. He just doesn't have like the energy or the patience to deal with this bullshit that is Hollywood of 2016.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I wish he would I wish he'd do things for the El Rey Network again with Rodriguez. Like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Come on, make this dream team happen. Like, get Tarantino, Rodriguez, and Carpenter together. Doing something, please.
Oh, that would be fantastic. To bring it back to Starman, now of course there was a Starman TV series.
There was,
which I remember watching as a kid because I liked the movie, and I was like, okay, now I have not seen it since 1985 or whenever it aired. Robert Hayes plays Starman. If you can't get your main choice, you go for Robert Hayes. Do you remember anything from the TV series? I have no memory.
I do.
Of it.
Yeah, I do. That was one of the things. Like, I watched that show religiously, like every Friday night when it was on. Because right around the time it was shortly after I saw the movie for the first time, and I was like obsessed with it because I was always a big sci-fi and comics kid and everything. So like I was completely obsessed with the show, and I would watch it with like my dad's always been like into like genre stuff too. So we would watch it together, and it's kind of basically The Fugitive with Robert Hayes and Christopher Daniel Barnes, who played Star Kid. Basically that wasn't the character's name. I forget the character's name.
It says Scott Hayden. I'm looking it up here on IMDb.
Scott Hayden.
Yeah.
Okay. Scott Hayden. So Christopher Daniel Barnes, you guys probably know, he played Greg Brady in the Brady Bunch movies, and he was also the voice of Spider-Man in the Fox 90s animated series. It was in a great underrated sitcom called Day by Day. And he's a guy who I wish did a lot more work, but this is one of the first things he ever did. And it was basically like a father-son bonding show, and they're on the road trying to avoid the government and, you know, trying to find what happened to Jenny. Robert Hayes, obviously, he's in a new body, and he's in like this photojournalist guy who was a bit of a player in his life before he died. So he's got to deal with, like, you know, I believe there were some, like, antics from, like, romances that the photojournalist failed, and he ran into old lovers and stuff. My memory on that isn't the clearest, but there was a really great two-parter where they find Jenny Hayden, and she's played by Erin Gray.
Yeah,
and Silver Spoon. So, you know, the show had its moments. Like most televised sci-fi of the mid to late 80s, it suffered from budget problems. And it suffered from cocaine writing a lot of the episodes. You know, it was like that kind of like sloppy wrap-up. The care wasn't put into it that it should have. Because, I mean, that's still an interesting idea for a show, to do kind of like a sci-fi fugitive type thing. Or to do, you know, what would it be like if this person came back from the dead, and how would you interact with them? I mean, there was a great Black Mirror episode that was kind of like that. So yeah, it's all available on DVD, and it's probably on YouTube as well. But it's like cheesy 80s fun, but Robert Hayes and Christopher Daniel Barnes have enough charisma to kind of sell the show and make it last. And it was only 13 hours, but it's the kind of thing that, you know, it's an idea that I feel never really got its full due in, like, film sequel or comics or some sort of ancillary media.
I'm a little dubious of the fact that the Jenny Hayden character is only in two episodes listed.
Well, yeah.
I'm like, now, come on, you know, to me, she's my favorite part of the thing. And you get
right.
You get rid of that character. Why would you do that? But
yeah, it's kind of, and they, like, yeah, it, they kind of had her being like this recluse, and yeah, it was kind of weak, but I think I believe what they were trying to do is, because that was near the end of the first season, I think they were going to have her as a much bigger presence in the second season, had it gone renewed.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, you know.
What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Like I said, it's still, you know, the movie is still in people's consciousness and it's still in its memory, which is great. And it's a wonderful movie. And I was really happy to see that interview with Karen Allen where she talked about it so warmly and everything else.
Yeah. Oh,
was great. I was really happy to hear that she had a good experience and that she remembers it fondly, which was really good. So is there anything else we want to talk about before we wrap up about Starman? Anything else you want to mention?
I think we should just talk again for like another like 3 hours about how great Karen is.
That is a done. We'll come back. You'll come back next week, and we'll
can
just
we do like an appreciation.
We'll go through the filmography. We'll just start with Animal House, and we'll just go from there. I mean, you and I are not big on The Sandlot, but I'm willing to watch it again.
Right?
I mean,
yeah. Oh, sure.
And
you know, count me in for Christmas if you want to do a Scrooge one.
Oh,
that is,
yeah,
that is
love
a Christmas
that movie.
That is my favorite Christmas movie. And there's a lot to say about what that movie could have been and what it turned out to be. And yeah, I love Scrooged.
Uh-huh.
And Karen Allen is such a great part of that movie's success.
Everyone who's listening, this show might be taking a turn as of this episode. It might become the Karen Allen podcast. I'm not sure.
A spinoff. Yeah. I just completely came on your show and took things over. I apologize.
You said no one's. I'm not going to complain about talking about Karen Allen. I'm just not. I will even watch Crystal Skull again just to do that. I will. That's the sacrifice I'm willing to make. That's Starman. If you have anybody who hasn't seen it, go see it. It's a wonderful movie. It's John Carpenter right in the middle of his incredible run of films. The guy was just tremendous, and he was able to make lots of different kinds of movies, and all of them interesting. Many of them are bona fide classics. The Thing is one of my all-time favorite movies of all time, period.
Yeah.
First movie I ever bought on DVD, The Thing. So, I mean, that's another whole podcast I could do, which is the John Carpenter run of films. So, but Starman is terrific. You can get it anywhere, so go find it. It's wonderful. So, Chris, thank you really so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. I wanted to talk about Starman so bad, and I was really worried that I wasn't going to get a chance to do it because I don't want to do these by myself. So thank you for volunteering.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on. I mean, I've been a fan of your stuff since Hey Kids Comics. So,
thank you very much.
This is just great. I knew we were definitely kindred spirits pop culture-wise, so
yes.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Do you have the other half of this amulet? I don't know. I think we might have some sort of weird backstory we have to explore here. I don't know. Where can people, before we sign off, where can people find you on the internet?
Best place to find me is on Twitter at either Bionic Bigfoot or Sci-Fi Explosion, or you can also follow my website, which is hibernationsickness.com, and that has links to all sorts of stuff that
great,
I'm up to.
The best names for these platforms you have yourself on. They have the greatest names. It took
me
a full second for hibernation. Oh, yes, of course. That's fantastic. So anyway, again, thank you for doing it. I really appreciate it. Anybody, of course, you want to email the show, it's firewaterpodcast@comcast.net. The Twitter feed is @filmandwaterpod. And you can find this show and all the other shows on the network over on fireandwaterpodcast.com. Again, Chris, thank you so much for coming on. Everybody,
thank you.
Everybody, thanks for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Getting back to Starman, there have been already some vague comparisons to E.T. in that the Jeff Bridges character is a sort of earthly E.T. or whatever. How do you answer that? Do you agree with that? Or
I think it's inevitable because it's a positive visitor from outer space movie. There haven't been many of them. even Day the Earth Stood Still was had Gort, who was a little dangerous in it. But it's all right with me if people compare it that way. I see it as much more of an old-fashioned road comedy. I think it's more like a 1930s or 40s film. It reminds me of the Depression films that
Capra
made, and also like Sullivan's Travels. It reminds me a little of the feel of that, what the feeling is out on the road and the kind of people in America.
Well, I think we can say that it's the antithesis, really, of The Thing, in that it is a very positive, a very optimistic film. And when you leave the theater, you leave feeling good.
Even though the ending is not entirely optimistic, right, in a sense. It's
Let's say you leave feeling fulfilled, satisfied, whatever.
That's right. That's right. And it is. It's the opposite of The Thing. It's just another point of view of things.
Yeah. This has been a fast half hour. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I want to wish you much success with
thank
your
you.
Movie Starman. It's a fine film, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. My thanks to all of you for watching. Until next time, good night.